questions. Sure. It's because I'm trying to expose the world to Sufism and this masjid through that path.
So maybe can you just tell me the history of this masjid in particular?
The history of this masjid, I would say, blossomed in the heart of Sheikh Musafir Ozak, whom I met in 1978. And he brought the lineage that we are now, you know, practicing, unfolding to these shores at that time. At that time, he met many of his disciples, among them Sheikh Noor, Lex Hickson. And Lex Hickson was really the one who took this stream of light and brought it into a new vessel, which is, you know, really fresh. It's Western also, but it's deeply traditional at the same time. Because this is one of the questions that a lot of Muslims have in their minds. Those who come from, you know, the East or Islamically cultural countries. You know, how do we adapt our religion, our faith to the West if we're living in the West? It's also a question in the hearts of young Western practitioners. How do we have a deeply spiritual way of life and yet not leave our Western values and Western forms, which we love and which are creative and new? So I feel that Noor, sort of in that fire of this time, which is such a threshold time, gave birth, just, you know, gave birth to this phoenix, I would say, and this path. And it's not just unique to our own. It's something, the spirit of it is in many paths that are springing up. And, you know, it's the same, I would say the same phoenix is rising in the West. Mm-hmm. Historically, therefore, it began in 1978 on the outer level. You know, of course, things in the spiritual world have prior history that we don't necessarily know about. But after Sheikh Musafir came, he had many disciples. He traveled across from east to west, this country, through major cities, met many people, loved the Americans, loved the American spirit, and almost, I think, was ready to move here, actually, to transplant. But he always did everything with divine permission. So he wasn't indicated that it was right for him to move. And he passed in 1984, at the end of 84, I think. And, no, in February 84. And at that time, Sheikh Noor then, you know, stepped onto a new level. Because his sheikh, Sheikh Musafir, our sheikh, was no longer around, you know, to be the vessel. So that was a time of great shift. And it was a very important time. And Noor kept this path and furthered and made it really blossom from 1984 until his passing in 1995. So for those 10 years, it was really what he called it, an experiment sometimes. You know, he enjoyed saying that because it wasn't just that everything was laid out for us, that there was some kind of formula, you know, as certain, sometimes in certain religious groups, you know, they like to think that they go by formulas. Well, all you have to do is this. And of course, that's not true for the real way. It's always new in every heart. Yes, you have guiding principles. And so Noor embodied those principles in our community, in this path, in a very luminous, very creative, very divine way. And, you know, I and many others now in the community, the entire community, we're carrying this forward, this ongoing experiment.
And at what point did you become the spiritual leader, the wine, or is that how do they say, I was reading a book where it said the sheikh has the wine and the dervish is the vessel.
Oh, really? Good. well, when Noor passed, yes, when Noor passed, then this is another mystery, you know, how it comes from one guide to the next, or one teacher. I really call myself a disciple. I'm a disciple still of Noor, like Sikhsen, and of Sheikh Muzaffar, and a disciple of this path, and a disciple of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. You know, if I may even say that. That sounds very exalted to say, but it came in at that time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there are others. We have Sheikh Amina in Mexico City, who's been holding that community and guiding that community for even longer, because Noor founded that, of course, before he passed.
I was here last weekend. You at one point called this Masjid a jewel box.
Yes. Yes.
And I thought it was so beautiful. And I wonder, what on a mystical level do you think have you seen evolve here over the years? What is really happening in mm-hmm. this place?
You know, an extraordinary unveiling of the human heart. That's really what happens here, and what has happened since 1980. The Masjid Al-Farah was founded by Sheikh Musfir in New York City, although it was in another building. It moved here after his passing. And it was Noor's term to call this a jewel box, because our other place was much bigger. This could fit, I think, into one floor of that, and we had three plus a big basement. But it was completely appropriate that we move here. And so, you know, size is important in, to some degree, but not really. You know, just as we say that if Allah Most High says that I do not fit into all 18,000 worlds, so there is the size, but I dwell and I fit into the heart of my believing servant. So, you know, within the minute, if you have the essence, then you have everything. And this masjid has represented that, you know, for ourselves and for many others. And it's kind of a secret key, I would say, secret essence within the city and within our human society at this time, for what it holds, that mystery, that gift, which I really see as the, you know, the La ilaha illallah, which is the, you might say, if you could reduce Islam, if you had to say what is Islam, the one thing that it is, it's La ilaha illallah. It's the living of that, the unfolding of that. And in a literal way, it means, you know, that there are no other realities apart from the one reality. And we say, we complete that, the cycle with Muhammad Rasulullah. And we in a universal way, Noor translated Muhammad with humanity, because, you know, each prophet stands for the entire human nation, just as every human being does. But a prophet even more so, because they are more manifest. They are realized human beings. So I would say that this masjid, this tariqat, this order, Sufi community, really embodies that. The La ilaha illallah Muhammadun Rasulullah.
I always found it amazing when coming here that there are so many people from so many different backgrounds. People mm-hmm. who were, you know, native Arabic speakers, and people mm-hmm. who were from so many places. And mm-hmm. is that usual in Sufi communities? Or?
I think in Sufi communities you'll find it more. The differences, because people are not drawn simply, you know, ethnically or culturally or age group. It's interesting how many, you know, divisions there are in the human family. Of course, you know, also by sex, whether you're male or female. But maybe it's somewhat special also with our group that we have so many different backgrounds. And I guess that's a gift of Sheikh Muzaffar, because I think when he inherited the tariqat, he found a few elder men practicing in the dergah there in Istanbul, because of course Sufism had been made illegal in Turkey by Atatürk, and so it was underground and not many followers. And he's the one who opened it out, brought in everybody fearlessly, opened it out, invited government officials, policemen, wealthy people, poor people, women, men. This is the kind of gathering. It was a Noah's Ark, you know. So that tradition of Noah's Ark is a prophetic tradition. So you could say the prophets also gathered all humanity. They didn't distinguish. They just called, you know, and God sends. And so every genuine Sufi community has that too. It is a Noah's Ark.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about, so I want to ask, you referred to this a bit about Islam today or something like that, but I wonder, well, let me preface it. Mm-hmm. It seems like Islam is vastly misunderstood in this mm-hmm. place, in this time. It's mm-hmm. having mm-hmm. It's experiencing some, you know, misunderstanding. And mm-hmm. I wonder why you think that is, and what is the real message of Islam that people should know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. I mean, it's difficult to talk about the real message. We can say that the real message is love. The real message is wisdom. The real message is humanity disappearing into the divine essence and living in human form as the divine essence. The real message is living on earth as if in paradise. The real message is really being the other, you know, living for all humanity, praying for all humanity. This is the real message. But it's, you know, it's easy to talk about, and it's the challenge is to actually live that and realize that. So if it's not lived, then it doesn't help so much to talk about it. And but, you know, one can point to sentences or passages in Holy Quran or into the whole of Quran. We can point to the life of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, his gentleness, his kindness, his humbleness, his nonviolence, his tolerance, his beauty, his openness, his communality, sharing of everything with others. There was no holding back on his part. He was totally immersed in God, totally at God's service for humanity, for the good of humanity. He's called the mercy to all humanity. He's called a light to guide humanity. So one can point to these things, and it's helpful to point to these things, but finally, you know, you must come back to how is it lived. And so if we're not living it, you know, it's not true. It's only as it's lived that it becomes true. So, you know, we aspire to that. We aspire to that. It's we are, you might say, melted in the fire of love. This is the Sufi path. The path is love. God is love. This is the Sufi vision. And by being melted in that fire of love, yes, we become, you know, beautiful human beings, you know, with faults, with still their humanity. So of course we make mistakes, and then of course we must always ask for forgiveness and remain humble, you know, and never feel that we have the answer or that we're doing great things or that we know, you know, better than anyone else. That would be, that's one of those traps, you know, sometimes further on the way of a spiritual path that can be worse than the early ones. So, yes, we aspire to live it. Well, everything happens in the name of Allah. Every single event in all 18,000 and more worlds happen in God's name. There's nothing that happens without God's permission and God's will. It doesn't mean that it's pleasing to Allah, you know. So just because one says, well, this is in, I do this in Allah's name, that doesn't mean that Allah is pleased with that act at all. And, you know, when one undertakes the slaughter of, you know, thousands of people, even the slaughter of one person or the slaughter even of a creature. This is prohibited in the deeper way of Islam. You don't kill an ant. You don't break a bough off of a tree. The Prophet, peace be upon him, said that cutting a tree is like killing a human being, you know, so, which is interesting things to explore for, you know, an environmental vision, a spiritual environmental vision. So, yes, you know, I knew a little bit of the mindset, maybe, of the people who had done that. First of all, maybe I even doubted that they had done it. Then maybe when it became more and more clear that they were on the plane, they had done it. Yes, I mean, I see that as a, you know, a terrible distortion, a sickness, and, you know, that can infest the human mind. But it's, you know, and then one has to look. And, of course, at the time, it was not appropriate to say, well, there are, you know, what were the conditions surrounding, why did they do that? It wasn't even appropriate to ask why. It's just appropriate to, you know, weep and feel awful with those people, but and their families. But now I think we can step back and say, you know, why were those people who presumably weren't, you know, monsters? I mean, maybe you'll get one or two. I mean, we have monsters. We know they're serial killers and things like that, or tyrants. But there is something, an underlying condition that creates this illness in that society. What is it? And both the West and the East have responsibility in that. Yes, it's the Islamic culture which has, you know, veiled the real shining core of Islam. You know, it has. You know, and therefore, you know, many of us don't feel comfortable there, and we're happy that we're in the West to unfold, you know, the vision of Islam that was given to us. There's also a responsibility on the part of the West, you know, as an economic superpower, political superpower. There is a responsibility. And I think, you know, in the dialogue in the coming years, the dialogue between East and West and between the different nations is happening, you know, in its own, you know, odd way. But it is happening.
Mm-hmm. I always find it... special that you're in New York City, you know, mm-hmm. You're not cloistered off in the woods,
right,
or the mountains, where,
right,
you're really in the place where there's like a full spectrum of light,
yes,
darkness.
That's true.
And I wonder
that's
how that affects.
Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, it's extraordinary, in fact. So that, you know, you're not just getting, you know, a limited slice. Again, that goes back to what you saw in the nature of the community. It's so variegated, so various, so diverse, and that's what New York City is. It's New York City is so amazing. It's really a kind of essence, like, of all the backgrounds, you know, around the globe, all the cultures, all the religions, all groups are somehow here living peacefully. Isn't that interesting? There's so much peace here, really, that we can say, well, it's very possible if you don't get, you know, big interferences, people of different spiritual, cultural, religious, ethnic backgrounds can live very peacefully on the globe. And this is why I'm saying also, you know, there is responsibility on the part of powerful nations, you know, to further, instead of, you know, interfering or controlling or, you know, overpowering, invading, killing, So instead, let's use, why can't we see the superpowers using their power in the way of love and wisdom and understanding to help, to draw out, to encourage, just as one would, you know, a child. But, you know, without looking down, because there are highly sophisticated people all around the globe, whether they live in the Amazon or whether they live in Islamic villages or, you know, up in among the, you know, the Inuit in the North Pole. I mean, they get all over the globe. And I think this is a very important point for each of us and for anyone who has any responsibility, and particularly the more power you have, the more important it becomes, to have reverence and respect for the innate greatness of humanity and of every individual, you know, whether you're born poor or rich with or without education. And these values will, you know, hopefully be furthered in the times to come. Because there is a growing society, global society forming. And the war, you know, prior to the invasion of Iraq, we saw amazing outpours of, you know, goodwill and of love, humanity. I mean, my husband and I were in a couple of, you know, we went to a few of those demonstrations against the war, and I think two in Washington, one in New York, and it was remarkable to see the spirit, the beauty of the human spirit, and to see that happening on television all over the globe. You realize there's something else happening. It doesn't, you know, the governments, you know, if they're not connecting to it, they're going to disappear of necessity, because finally it is humanity that wins, that is victorious.
Mm-hmm. I felt also that way at those demonstrations.
Yes.
It wasn't just people weren't only saying what they didn't want, they were manifesting the next world.
Yeah, exactly. Manifesting the next world. And this is what the younger people and older people, whoever, people of goodwill, are preparing for. They're preparing for the next time, you know, and it could be tomorrow, or it could be in a couple of years, or in a few years, and it's already here now, basically. That's what we should realize. Just assume it's here, and that these other things that are going on, these other currents, you know, of misunderstanding, of destruction, of they're there, but they're not, you know, they're not holding back this great, great outpouring of the human heart. And so the more we just stay in the heart, the more we realize that our place is the heart. This is where God is. Let's be here. We don't really have too much to strive for out there. If we are human beings, and we are human beings with each other, we will have an amazing civilization coming, you know, that will, yes, that will have probably extraordinary technology, you know. Maybe some of the older technology will pass away, and there'll be amazing new things, amazing creative things. Human society will, you know, bind together in an extraordinary way. You know, look at the rainbow gatherings, you know. So something, you know, a rainbow humanity. Wouldn't that be beautiful? You know, with all the prophets together, side by side, not misunderstanding between religions. Everyone standing together as one. That would be amazing. And I like to say it's already here. It really is. There are enough people who are, you know, realizing this, to say it's here already. In Israel, it's happening. Palestine, it's happening in some smaller ways. I think Israel, certainly the culture there, because it has more of the entire Western input, you know, but in Palestine, it is happening too among people, and it's happening all over. Here in New York, in Europe, it's South America, North America, East, West, it's happened.
In places where it is happening, in places where people are struggling with seeing that pluralistic, you know, vision, where there's this, they imagine that Christianity is at war with Islam, or Islam is at war with Judaism, or what is it that's holding them back from, like, the boundarylessness, you know?
Mm-hmm. What is holding them back? Yeah. Well, some are not held back, you know, and this is the practice in our way is not, it's seamless, and therefore, you know, we're not here just adhering to an Islamic tradition, historical tradition, although we do that and we uphold that and the wisdom of that and the beauty of that, but you know, many of us are also, you know, from Christian backgrounds, Jewish backgrounds, Buddhist backgrounds, and we practice to some more or less degrees in those other traditions, happily, or, you know, or we visit, or we visit each other maybe on certain holy times. So our vision is completely all embracing. It's just that you only have so much energy and life force to give, you know. So generally you will find yourself practicing more in one tradition than another, but the currents move in all directions. Yeah.
And what is our responsibility? You said before about the demonstrations and being in this world. What is our responsibility, do you think, to, as much as we know the next world is coming, the world of peace, what is our earthly responsibility? or
our earthly responsibility is to know ourselves. This is what the prophet said. He said, know yourself and you will know your Lord. This is an obligation for every human being. And when the human knows herself and himself, they are transformed because they become what they are. And what they are is the crown of creation. What they are is the divine vessel for all the divine attributes. So that is, I would say, the responsibility of every human being to pursue that path of self-knowledge. And then you will naturally be compassionate because the human being is created that way. You will have intelligence, you will have humor, you will have everything, you know, that's needed to make a wonderful human society. And, you know, we can say, of course, along with knowing yourself. Knowing yourself does not just mean sitting isolated in a cave or a room, you know, or even a community. So it's not just, you know, it's not isolation, but it's a quest. And that quest takes place wherever you are, you know, in the workplace, on vacation, as you go to sleep, as you wake up, in your dreams. And it's always ongoing. Once you kind of receive that initiation to the quest, which is what we offer in a Sufi community, you know, is the hand-taking, the initiation, it unfolds of itself. And of course we put in effort. You know, of course we offer practices. We pray. We join together. We restrain, you know, our bad habits. And we encourage the good things in ourselves. So that's a kind of level of effort and work and practice. But essentially, it's really unfolding itself. All this happens by divine grace alone, as we look deeper. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sharing, very important, sharing. Mm-hmm. Sharing on all levels, you know, the sharing economically. And this is also, of course, one of the Islamic principles, you know, that you share the wealth. There's a certain proportion of wealth that's to be shared. But that can be done just as a formula, again, or it can be done in the deepest way, that you want to share all aspects of yourself, all gifts that God gives to you, you know, and the material is the least.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
It's like manifesting your true self.
Yes, and sharing that with others. Manifesting your true self and sharing it with others. Because if you don't really know yourself, if you're not in that deepest place of yourself, or let's say, or somewhere near that, in the, you know, environs of that, you don't have that much to offer. And it will be more obligatory, you know, and not much good comes from people doing things in an obligatory way. You could say a certain amount of good, yes, they're restrained from doing terrible things from each other. And that's, I would say, the greater part of religion restrains people from doing terrible things, you know, takes them to a certain level of conscience. But the mystical path in all the traditions take us to the core of what it is to be human, which is to be divine. And that's where, you know, just the miraculous unfolds.
Of all, I know that you're very...
No, I'm not. I have to contradict you right away. No, I don't have that much learning.
Mm-hmm. But of the teachings of Muhammad, what do you think would be the most useful and accessible to Americans now?
To Americans. Mm-hmm.
Who are not necessarily...
religiously oriented or you know, or even, or somewhat sort of, are scared of Islam or... Well, the one I just mentioned, know yourself and you will know your Lord. I would say that's a very contemporary one, really, because a lot of young people are very interested in spiritual quest and they're interested in knowledge, you know. And I would say that's probably the key one that I would offer if one had to offer something from the entire tradition. You know, after La ilaha illallah, which is a form of praise, really, and that's what we offer in the zikr. The zikr is built with La ilaha illallah and flows through La ilaha illallah. You know, but that you know, to unfold the meaning of that in a rational way, we could go on and on and on and fill books and books and books. And as Sheikh Muzaffar said, he said, all the prophets, all the holy books, all, if they were to be essentialized, they all say simply, La ilaha illallah, you know, which means one divine reality alone, manifesting in all these countless beautiful forms as human beings, you know, as holy creation. And but in each time, in each era, you know, according to the prophet who was bringing that teaching for humanity, so that there is no separate self, there's no alienation, we are one. And each prophet would have their own, you may, might say, rank with God. And so they would, it said, you know, whether it wasn't necessarily literally said in that way, but on a spiritual level. So, La ilaha illallah Adam Safiullah, you know, and Hawa Safiullah. So that divine reality alone exists, and Adam and Eve are the pure humanity. La ilaha illallah Nu Najiullah. Divine reality alone exists, and Noah is the savior of humanity in the Ark of Prophecy. I call it the Ark of Prophecy. And it goes on. Every prophet who has come has, as I said, a certain name, divine name, given to them. But to go back to your question about, you know, what out of the entire Mohammedan treasury of teaching would I share, I think it's that one. If I had to just pick one, you know, it's know yourself and you will know your Lord.
What do you see happening between Jews and Muslims now? In the years?
Between Jews and Muslims, inshallah, only good. I mean, we say that everything that happens is divine mercy and divine guidance, so that even if something is painful, it's guidance, and therefore it's mercy. So what's unfolding now, as you know, as conflict in some parts of the world, clearly in the Holy Land, will help to reveal the treasure. You know, that's if we don't look at just the incident itself, if we look at the long view, you know, at the meaning within. There are many places where Jews and Muslims are communing quite beautifully, you know, and this is one of them. I would say the Masjid al-Farah in New York City and all the Sufi circles of this Sufi community across the United States and in Mexico, they're communing quite beautifully, you know, and enjoying, you know, discovering each other. So it shows it's possible.
And they're really uncovering the same truth, I suppose.
Yes, really. Of course. But each one has a richness, you know, that will enrich the other. And that's the beauty also. So it's a sameness, you know. And yet even, you know, but it has a different flavor. It's like you would, you know, if you, sometimes you travel to different lands, you know. Well, yes, I mean, they have trees and grass and mountains. But each one is, you know, unique. So you're so happy, actually, to make the discovery of completely different forms. When I went to Hawaii for the first time a few years ago, I was kind of struck by all the trees, except for the palm tree, you know, looked so different. I had never seen them before. It was kind of fascinating. So I think also in the spiritual traditions, it's so great that there's so much divine knowledge. And each spiritual tradition is like, you know, ocean of divine knowledge, that is, or oceans upon oceans of divine knowledge, that it like reservoirs there for humanity. And so to come upon that is it's intoxicating. And to share that, you know, is what we're invited to do this time. This time has special permissions. This time is a new time. And there are openings now and invitations that were not really so present before, maybe just for a few. You know, there had been interfaith events leading, of course, all the way back. We speak of Spain, we speak of Egypt, of course, the Holy Land. it existed, but I mean, to the degree that it's possible today, it did not exist.
I mean, in terms of linear years, like 10 years ago or 1,000?
Oh, well, yes, in the history of humanity, I would say there's just, you know, an evolution that keeps going. And even, as you say, even 10 years ago, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, when Sheikh Muzaffar came to this country, things were very different, you know. And it was like the sprouts, the tiny little seedlings were there. And mainly Sheikh Muzaffar dealt with seeds, potential, you know, of people who were in kind of seed form, you know, called them babies. And there were a few seedlings. And then there were a few mature, more mature, not, you know, maybe one or two, I guess. I don't know. He could see them. But today, all those little seedlings have grown, and they're growing into, you know, young trees, and it's an amazing sight. And so they're going to make big forests that will become like primeval forests, you know, of spiritual joy over the globe.
One last question, just to, for the September 11th thing. What specifically happened here during September 11th? Did you close down? Or?
Yeah, well, we had to, because no one was allowed below canal, I think. And so I think for 2 weeks we didn't come to the masjid. I think it was about 2 weeks. And we met in one of our dervish apartments, she on Great Jones Street or something around there. And, you know, but it was such a tumultuous, overwhelming event. But mainly it increased prayer, you know. It increased goodwill. That was our feeling. So it never really made a break at all. Just physically, we couldn't come here. But, you know, as soon as we could, we began meeting here again. Although there was dense smoke at the time. And then we did also some interfaith gatherings, you know, at the time.
The one at Netanya's house on the Upper East Side?
Yes.
We had that dinner,
like, yes. Yes, you were there.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That was amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And because you have to go, I wanted to ask one last question. Mm-hmm. It always seems fairly like, not genderless, but seeing the essence of the person outside their gender. And has it ever been unusual? Is it unusual for a woman to be at your level of...
In Islam? Yes, yes, yes. I mean, they will, you know, the story goes that, of course, there were many women teachers and throughout. And that's true. You see, it's at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, women were, through revelation of Holy Quran, women went from being property to individual citizens with a complete set of rights. And not only that, but on a mystical level, he drew women very close to himself. The original masjid in Medina, the quarters of his wives were giving directly onto the masjid, you know, which would be inconceivable in a fundamentalist Islamic culture, that which shows how far they strayed from the original spirit, which was, you know, so close to the feminine. And he said, you know, God has made dear to me women, perfume, and prayer. Do you hear that? God has made dear to me, of all the things on the earth, women, perfume, and prayer. And women came first. So even prior to prayer, I mean, a fundamentalist, you know, would never be able to say that, or, you know. So this is radical. And this is what you see living in Sufi communities, is that preciousness of the divine feminine, yes. Mm-hmm. In both men and women, yes. Mm-hmm. Of men, very important, you know. So it's not a gender issue. Yeah.
In the Arab world, in the Muslim world, what is the awareness of the Sufism? Is it something that people...
Well, in some countries, Sufism is still existing and valued. And in others, not. You know, it's even in Turkey, where our tariqat is, you know, rooted from. It came from there. Most recently, you know, Sufism is illegal. And if you ask around the general population, they don't have a good view of Sufism. Well, of course, because that's also what they were taught in schools. And it was, you know, they were educated to think of Sufism as something for, you know, people who are not like honest or excessive or, you know, basically it got all the bad attributes. And, of course, in Saudi Arabia, it's not really legal. It exists, though. I think it exists almost everywhere, whether it's legal or not legal. In Morocco, though, for instance, where there's, interestingly enough, there's a king culture, Sufism is doing quite well. And if you know, it's different according to every country and very much according to their, you know, historical, political, social history. Of course, in the past, it was always there. It's the basis of every civilization, Islamic civilization, is Sufism. It really is Islam, in my understanding. It is Islam. And when the other is, you know, a falling away. And, you know, you can have a level of Islamic culture, but not really without Sufism. It doesn't work. You know, maybe for a certain number of years, one generation, but if it's not nourished again, it'll become a hardened set of rules and lose all the joy, you know, because Sufism is really about the transformation of the human heart. So how can you have a truly religious person who has not have their heart totally transformed? Since you asked about, you know, transmitting Sufism back to the Arabic and Islamic world, I would say that in 1954, Sheikh Muzaffer was asked by the Turkish government what could they do to improve their image in the West. And it was, even the way he tells the story is very humorous, because he at the time was a young sheikh, but he was already in Sufism. And he preached at all the great mosques. He was a known preacher and teacher, a very great figure. But when the government called him to Ankara, he was very nervous. He thought, oh no, you know, they're going to cut me short, or they're going to put me in jail, or what have I done, you know. But so they called him into this little room and, you know, offered him a tea, and he was very nervous the whole time. And then the question that came out is, how can we improve our image in the West? And his response was, send the whirling dervishes to the West. And the tekke of the whirling dervishes at the time had been closed. It had been closed for a generation or more, maybe since Ataturk, you know, maybe a long generation. And it was filled just with bird droppings. It was, you know, broken panes. And they gave him permission. He said, if you give me permission, I will open the tekke. I will invite back the old teachers, and we will revive the practice of whirling, and we will send them to the West. And they supported that. And ever since that time, you know, of course, the whirling dervishes have become the symbol, the kind of logo of Turkey, and they love it for that reason. But it was Sheikh Muzaffer's initiative to, you know, that allowed that, permitted that. And so he called back the old teachers, and Suleiman Dede, you know, who became then the head of the lineage, and brought it to the West. And we have disciples here. We have dervishes in our community who were initiated by Suleiman Dede after the reopening of the Mevlevi Tekke in Konya. At that time, it was 1956.
And what is the essence of the whirling?
Essence of whirling is God intoxication, God finding, losing self, finding God, and finding self in God. That's the essence of the whirling.
Something about the axis also, I remember you said.
Yes, yes. Well, as we whirl, we realize, you know, ourself as the axis. We realize that saying that God says, I dwell in your hearts. You know, I do not fit into creation, but I dwell in the human heart. And something of the whirling makes that very clear. You whirl in your own axis. You become your own, you know, you are the universe. You are all the divine attributes. Whirling around the essence of God. That's what the human being is. A human being is a creation in itself. Every human is an entire creation, an entire might say, unfolding of the divine names, whirling around the essence of God.